From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, and today for Celeste Headley. With just 17 days to go before Election Day, we have the results of an Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll out just this morning on where Georgia voters stand. Spoiler alert, the presidential race is really, really close here in Georgia, amazingly. And if you feel stressed by the campaign season, hey, you're not alone.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Well, that's one of the topics that our break room panel is going to tackle later this hour. But first, we devoted an hour on Tuesday to the present state of journalism, especially in light of the 2016 election. We discussed whether the media still has an obligation to get their lines right and whether or not they have an obligation to be objective. Here are your first thoughts on Twitter. Amanda Respis says, a lot of journalists are bloggers, but few bloggers are journalists, right? Yes, consumers need to vet their news sources. Chi Jo K tweets, I agree, commentary and reporting need to be clearly labeled because the line between the two has become blurred on some news sites. And Ted Bartolo writes on Facebook, is it just me or has the media just dominated everyone's thinking this election? Not so sure about everyone, Ted, but certainly not just you. We also want to thank everyone who sent messages yesterday on Second Thoughts page and Twitter, talking about how excited you are as the show celebrated its 2-year anniversary. You are the reason why the staff here does this program every day, and everybody really does appreciate your support and your continued listenership. And as we hope you know by now, we always want to hear what's on your mind. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we just might feature your comments on the show. America will elect a new president in a matter of weeks, and if you follow the latest polls, you probably have a pretty solid handle on how the big contest is likely to turn out. But the polls have been anything but steady here in Georgia. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has surveyed Georgia voters this election season, and the paper's final poll results are out today. Here to talk about the results is Greg Bluestein. He's a political reporter for the AJC. Welcome back, Greg.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Always lovely to have you. Before we start, how does the AJC conduct these polls?
Well, we did a poll from October 17th through October 20th, and it included 839 likely voters. More than 1,000 registered voters overall were polled, and the margin of error is about 4%.
Okay. Now, right now, who's got the advantage in Georgia, Trump or Clinton?
It is deadlocked. It is 44 Trump, 42 Clinton, which is well within the margin of error, which means we've got a tight race on our hands here in Georgia.
Yeah, 4-point margin of error. Now, listen, Greg, I hate to do this to you, but this time 2 years ago, an AJC poll had Democrats Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter leading in the races for Senate and governor in Georgia, respectively, and they were both handily defeated just a few weeks later. Have you guys made any adjustments to your polling model since then?
You're exactly right. And 2 years ago, you saw that the national race sort of broke towards the Republicans near the end. And you're right. Our poll and other polls were predicting runoffs in the governor and Senate race. A lot can happen over the next 2.5 weeks here in Georgia as well. Republicans still have a huge advantage. Most of their voters are over Trump's sort of bulwark. Are voters over 65 years old? They're the most likely to show up at the polls. They tend to show up at the polls no matter what. And so that's a huge advantage in his corner. The advantage still goes to Trump, I'd think, no matter what. But Clinton is certainly, on his heels.
And your poll shows that there's about 4% of Georgia likely voters who remain undecided. As unfathomable as that may be.
I don't get it. But?
Well, honestly, we joke about it, but it's just like, I bet, in fact, I know personally some folks who, you know, would normally vote Republican, and they're thinking they might vote Democratic, but they just haven't quite gotten themselves there psychologically. I bet that describes a whole lot of people, especially in the Atlanta suburbs.
I think it does, and I think that also accounts for why Libertarian Gary Johnson is doing so well in a poll. He's at 9% in the poll.
9%. That's a really substantial. That's meaningful.
That is a huge margin for a party that, you know, barely cracked a few percentage points back in 12 and in 2008. So that could be the game changer. If he is pushing double digits and Hillary Clinton can get what the baseline Democrats get, then it's going to be a neck and neck race.
Right. Well, let's talk about what's behind these numbers. Let's listen to a clip from the last presidential debate. Here, Hillary Clinton brings up Trump's treatment of women, and he chimes in himself. Let's take a listen.
Donald thinks belittling women makes him bigger. He goes after their dignity, their self-worth, and I don't think there is a woman anywhere who doesn't know what that feels like. That's who Donald is.
Mr. Trump,
nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
And, of course, the audience actually laughed there. Mm-hmm. Greg Bluestein from the AJC, how have Trump's comments perhaps affected female voters in Georgia?
Well, there's a giant gender gap, as you'd expect, in Georgia. Trump has built a solid lead among men with about a 50 to 35% margin over Clinton. But women favor Clinton by a 48 to 37% of the vote. And wow. 64% of women have an unfavorable view of Trump, while 66% of men have an unfavorable view of Clinton. So there is a stark gender gap here.
Wow. Yeah, that's big. Are voters divided when it comes to age?
Yeah, and this is the troubling thing for Clinton supporters. Almost one in five voters under 39 are backing Gary Johnson. This is an age group that if Clinton were to really compete in Georgia, she needs to be winning by an overwhelming margin. But instead, many, many young voters are still going with either third-party candidate Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, who's not actually on the ballot, but she can still be a write-in candidate. While, as I said earlier, a majority of older voters older than 65 back Trump, and those voters are always the most likely to show up at the polls.
Yeah, and it's amazing how the issues valued by young voters versus older voters are so different. One of the big very, very top issues cited by younger voters again and again in polls is marijuana legalization. And I just saw a national poll this morning finding that support for marijuana legalization nationwide is much, much higher than support for Trump or for Clinton. And yet only one of those three things will win in a few weeks, and it's not going to be pot.
Nope, but, not at all.
Has the GOP been successful in courting minority voters at all in Georgia?
They are really, really struggling with minority voters. Our poll showed that only 3% of black voters are backing Trump, and that's within the margin of error right there. Nearly 90% are behind Clinton, and those are Obama numbers. If she gets 90% plus, that means there's really little sort of fading from black voters for her support.
How did Georgia voters feel about Hillary Clinton and in particular her honesty?
Yeah. So both Trump and Clinton had sky high unfavorable ratings. They're both about nearly 60% of voters both had dim views of them. But in particular, that was actually almost the exact same numbers we got from our last poll in August. So those numbers have tracked pretty steadily. But they both have, voters said both had very different issues. For Clinton, it was honesty problems. A majority of Georgia voters, that's 56%, believe she's qualified to serve as president, but almost two-thirds don't see her as honest or trustworthy, including nearly all Republicans. I think it was 98% of Republicans thought that way, and one quarter of Democrats, which shows she still has lingering problems within her own party on that issue.
Sure. We're talking about a new poll from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution out this morning. It finds that Trump and Clinton are in a dead heat in Georgia, a statistical tie just weeks before the election. Talking to Greg Bluestein, political reporter at the AJC. Overall, Greg, what does your poll say about how Georgians are feeling about the state of their country?
It is a pessimistic outlook, as it's been in pretty much every poll we've done as well, and every national poll that we've seen, too. two-thirds of Georgia's voters say the country is on the wrong track. That includes 90% of Republicans and a huge chunk of Democrats. So there are a lot of people who are just not happy with the way the country's going, even though President Obama actually gets a 50% approval rating. So there are
in Georgia, 50% approval rating for Obama.
Yeah, in Georgia. And so there's people upset with Congress. There's people upset with the economy. But they're not exactly, they're not specifically upset at Obama. There's plenty of people upset at Obama, but not a majority. It's evenly split there.
Let's take a listen to another clip from that last debate. Moderator Chris Matthews, who I'm going to say I think did a pretty darn good job, asked Trump if he would accept the results of the election if he lost. And here's what Trump said.
Do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time.
Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Okay. From your data, Greg, will Georgia voters be wanting to contest the results of the election if Mr. Trump loses?
You know, the Trump's claims of a rigged election really haven't gained that much traction here. Nearly 80% of voters say they're confident their vote for president will be accurately counted. And of course, that includes the vast majority of Republicans saying that. And only 10% of Georgians say they will not accept the outcome of the election if the candidate they support loses. And of those 10%, most of them were Democrats. So the rigged election claims just aren't really generating much traction here in Georgia.
Huh. Well, this is another clip from Wednesday's debate. Here's Trump talking about how the election is rigged against him. Let's take a listen.
If you look at your voter rolls, you will see millions of people that are registered to vote that shouldn't be registered to vote. Tell you one other thing. She shouldn't be allowed to run. She's guilty of a very, very serious crime. And just in that respect, I say it's rigged.
And then here is how Clinton responded to Trump's claim about the election being rigged.
The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged against
him. Should have gotten it.
So, Greg, I mean, all of that being the backdrop to your polling, it's really, really remarkable to me that the AJC's poll found that it was Democrats more so than Republicans who say that they would not accept the result of the election if their candidate lost. That is just very surprising to me.
And my
Go ahead.
I was just saying my guess is just because all the polls, national polls, poll after poll shows her with such a commanding lead in the polls right now and, you know, such a huge advantage in the electoral map that you know, her supporters are saying there's no way she can lose at this point.
All right. We've got 1 minute left here, Greg. Let's talk really quickly about down ballot. How, if at all, is this presidential election affecting the race for Georgia's U.S. Senate seat currently held by Johnny Isaacson? He's facing a challenge from Democrat Jim Barksdale.
And Barksdale is aggressively trying to tie Isaacson to Trump at every corner, at every turn. And I think they are sort of softening his numbers. He's at 47% in our poll, which is still a big lead over Barksdale, but still not above the 50% margin he needs to avoid a runoff. And his campaign does not want to see this race drag into January.
How much do you think Michelle Nunn wishes she had waited 2 years to run for Senate?
I think there's a lot of Democrats right now that are kicking themselves for not running this year.
Greg Bluestein is a political reporter for the AJC. You can find a link to the results of their poll at gpbnews.org. Thank you, as always, Greg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome to med school.
Dr. Jean Sumner is the dean of Mercer University School of Medicine. On this day, she stands before two dozen high school students. Why?
We don't have enough applicants from rural Georgia. We're really trying to look for ways to build up our applicant pool from those areas because those are the kids we want. We need to develop a farm team.
Farm team takes added meaning when you consider the audience comes from 4-H clubs in southeast Georgia. It's a first for Mercer and the state 4-H organization, giving rural kids a taste of what it's like to be in medical school. From simulating doctor-patient conversations.
Hi, my name is Dr. Kelly. I'll be helping you out today.
To learning how to test a reflex.
You're hitting the tendon here, okay? And then it's Don't be shy.
After she taps the knee, McKinley Cranford explains her hope to serve her hometown as a pediatrician.
Just helping people that I've always known, and then like my friends, kids, and people like that that come back to Cochrane, that I'd want to help them.
Laura Harker is healthcare policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. She likes the Mercer 4-H recruitment effort, but
it's really important to focus on the current issues with rural hospitals and clinics that they're facing with having to care for so many people living in poverty or who are uninsured and not able to pay for care.
That can lead to rural hospitals in shaky financial condition, and that can make small towns unattractive to doctors. So Mercer is thinking outside the box, seeking out kids who already know rural life really well and hopefully like it enough to want to go back after college. Frank Carter is on the Georgia 4-H Foundation's board of directors. He's also a physician practicing in Waynesboro, population 5,800.
So that is the beauty of this program and where we hope it sticks, is that you get rural youth that understand small towns and like small towns and will live in a small town.
People like Nick Morrow.
I'm going back home. I'm from a small town in northwest Georgia, and that's where I'm going back to.
Morrow is a current medical student at Mercer. When he graduates, he wants to practice near Cartersville. Morrow says young people in rural areas need help to see what's possible in health care.
There's plenty of children in these small towns, just like me, that have the aptitude to do these things. It's just sometimes they don't end up doing that with their life because they don't have a clear path in front of them. Their dads and moms aren't doctors and lawyers. You know, they come from a rural background.
Morrow is just the kind of person Mercer hopes to find through the 4-H. To help, the medical school has set aside a $35 million state grant for scholarships to any medical student, 4-H or not, willing to work in a rural setting. For GPB News, I'm Michael Caputo in Macon.
Well, it's been another long week. We talked about the pros and cons of casino gambling in Georgia. We evaluated whether journalists still have an obligation to be objective. And we discussed the role that athletes play when they take on social activism. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of very smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think back about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Everyone knows, of course, Hillary's belief that it takes a village, which only makes sense, after all, in places like Haiti, where she's taken a number of them.
Gee, Bert, you'd rather read some book than play ball?
It's not just some book, Ernie. It's a really good book, and I want to finish it.
We love our chicken wings. It's like my favorite thing to eat. Every time I eat them, I get the sauce all over my face, all over my hands. I need like a million napkins because it's so messy.
Hey, who doesn't? Joining us in the break room are Roxanne Donovan. She's the assistant chair of the Interdisciplinary Studies Department and a professor of psychology and interdisciplinary studies at Kennesaw State University. Welcome, Roxanne.
Morning.
Hector Fernandez directs the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University. Hi, Hector.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. With me here in GPB's Macon studio is Charles Richardson. He is the editorial page editor for the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. Welcome back, Charles.
Good morning, everybody.
I should probably turn on your mic for you there.
Good morning, everybody.
There we go.
Yeah.
And making her break room debut is Julianne Thompson. She's a former press secretary for the Georgia Republican Party. Hey, welcome, Julianne.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you via the Skypes there. Folks, it's not an exaggeration to say that the 2016 campaign has been pretty vicious, and things got even uglier last night at the Al Smith Dinner. This is an event to raise money for Catholic charities in New York City, and it has historically been sort of a lighthearted night where both candidates roast each other, but gently, kind of retirement party jokes, more so than like Comedy Central roast type jokes. But by the end of Donald Trump's remarks, he was being repeatedly booed by the audience. Let's listen.
Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics.
Yeah. So Hillary got in some zingers as well. And the last 18 months or so have been enough to make just about everybody ready for this election to be over. This week, the American Psychological Association said a survey showed more than half of Americans are stressed about the election. The psychology experts published a list of tips for how to deal with the next few weeks. Folks, are you feeling stressed? How do you cope? Do you stop reading the news? And Roxanne, you feeling stressed about the election?
Oh, I'm in the half that's stressed for sure. In fact, at the debate, 45 minutes in, I had to just get up and walk away because I was holding tension in my body. It was really, really bad. So
yeah.
What do
how
I do?
You, what do you do? Yeah, what do you do?
I don't read the comments when I read the news.
Don't read the comments.
And I take social
Never
media
read the
breaks.
Comments.
Oh, I try not to. Sometimes I get sucked in, but I really, really try not to.
Well, Hector, how you feeling? How's your self-care?
No, I'm not stressed. I'm exhausted. You know, whenever, every now and then I'm dropping the radio station, I'm changing the channel. I'm so turned off by some of the rhetoric. And whenever I see somebody annoying show up, basically, that's it for me. I'm limiting audio and imagery to a minimum. I mostly read the coverage, but hey, I'm not a masochist. So if I find something distasteful, well, I turn it off, basically.
Charles, you're a man with a very calm comportment. Is that deception? Are you dying inside?
Well, I'm with Hector. You know, you reach a certain point where you just don't want to listen to it anymore. And part of my job is to listen to it.
Yeah, that's the thing that stinks, doesn't it? I really wish I could tune out, but I just can't.
So you're sort of drawn to it like a moth is to a flame. And once that wing starts to catch fire and you start to lose altitude, you sort of have to back away. You know, you back away from the cliff. And you start looking at these people in a whole different light. Like, did you really say something that stupid? You know, do you really believe this? And then you realize that even they're smiling. They say, this is the act I've got to put on. And they're smiling. And I remember I was watching, I think, Anderson Cooper, and he's got this grin on his face like, you just said that? Are you kidding me? So, you know, you take it with a lot of salt, and you just make sure you have no shoes when you're watching on your couch because you just might throw one through your TV.
Julianne Thompson, we've got your Skype connection reestablished there. I imagine that this election season is different for you psychologically, being someone who used to work at a very high level with the state Republican Party. You have a personal stake in this.
Yes, and I was also assistant press secretary in the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee. So the way that public image has always been extremely important to me. As far as the Al Smith dinner last night, it was funny to a certain respect. I think the first part of Donald Trump's remarks were funny, and then it kind of went downhill from there. Certainly with this election, you know, I couldn't have called it the way that it went. You asked me a year ago, I would have said Donald Trump will be out of this race within 30 days. And he made a lot of what I considered to be gaffes and got bumps in the polls right afterwards. So you can't really call the way this election is going, but it certainly has been a stressful one.
I bet. I just bet. Now, speaking of the campaign, folks, Donald Trump invited President Obama's estranged half-brother to the final presidential debate Wednesday night. Malik Obama lives in Kenya and supports Trump. Also on the Trump guest list was a woman whose son was killed in the 2012 attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton brought a high-profile GOP defector Meg Whitman, who ran unsuccessfully for governor of California, also billionaire Mark Cuban, who has made no secret of his negative feelings about Trump in public remarks. Guys, what do you think about this tactic of inviting your opponents, your opponents' enemies, maybe too strong a word to use, but your opponents' opponents to the debates to maybe psych them out? Roxanne, what do you think?
I can't believe this is happening. It's almost surreal. I just wish they would stop playing these middle school mind games and work harder to challenge each other with actual data, facts, explanations, policies, you know. They're trying to psych each other out, but I can't imagine that it's working, and it's a lot of time and energy. Hey, invite me to the debate. I actually want to be there, and, well, no, maybe I don't. Never mind. Go on.
Go ahead, actor.
Listen, if you want to make a valid policy case, like in the State of the Union, then I see it happening. But if it's just
you mean like bringing someone to be an example of
exactly,
a point that you
exactly,
want to illustrate,
exactly.
Right?
That would should make it valid. But if the whole point is to annoy your rival or just to get under their skin, there's only a word for that. That's juvenile. For Christ's sake, this is a presidential race. We're talking about the United States of America here.
Well, Hector, remember, this entire race has been juvenile. So,
but hold on. You know, gamesmanship is nothing new to politics.
Nothing new, but nobody knows whether Hillary Clinton even knows what Barack Obama's brother looks like.
Good point.
Yeah, well.
You know, did he make a cameo appearance? Did they have a press conference with him before the debate? I mean, are you supposed to be, ooh, there's Barack Obama's brother. Whoa. You know, or Mark Cuban. I mean, who's he supposed to scare? You know, if he brought a couple of his basketball players there that are 7 foot tall, that might make an appearance, but my goodness, it is. It's just, if you are on that stage, there's enough stuff to take you off your game other than Meg Whitman.
Julianne Thompson, what do you make of it as a tactic?
Well, I agree with everything that everybody has said so far. I think it's juvenile, and I certainly wouldn't have advised, at least on the Republican side, for Trump to do that. But let's face it, this has become a reality TV election, and there are no innocent parties here. There are no angels in this presidential election. Both sides are guilty of doing the same exact thing. So I agree with what everybody else said.
Whoa. We're going to compare apples with oranges there. I mean,
that's a false equivalency.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
when it comes to intimidation tactics at debates, that's what we're talking about.
We're talking about, you know, the general show. I mean, if you describe it as a reality show election, you know, definitely you have to score somebody higher, way higher.
Well, the question was, how did I feel about the intimidation tactics at the debates? And that's what I'm referring to, and that's what I answered.
All right. As long as we clarify that it hasn't been the same thing and the same show on both sides, right?
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and leave that there, and let's talk about something really important, which is that apparently eating chicken wings with a man is a problem for some women. There's all sorts of advice online claiming to have the best way to eat them. Some are how-to videos. Let's listen to a woman from Buffalo asking comedian and talk show host Steve Harvey for help with this particular crucial dilemma.
I'm a single girl. I go on a lot of dates. I always go out to eat, and I always order my wings. My problem is these guys are looking at me like they're disgusted. So I need you to show me a more ladylike way to enjoy my buffalo wings without being so messy.
Okay, so a new and quite expensive club has opened in New York City. It's for women only, giving them a place to eat chicken wings in peace without judging men around. The price tag is between $1,500 and $2,000 a year. Julianne, I'll start with you. Are women really this worried about what men think about their gustatory habits when it comes to the wings of certain fowl?
You know, I don't even know how to answer that. I really don't. This is such an irrelevant topic.
Sorry, boss. Just trying to have a little fun on a Friday.
I know. But I guess
what do you call it?
It is fun in light of this entire election that we've had to deal with. But I doubt it. I don't think it's anything that women are concerned about.
Roxanne, the listeners are dying to know your feelings.
Oh, I'm eating wings like it's going out of style, and I don't care who's watching. But I really had to figure out what was behind this wing place. So I went to the website, and what I realized, at least in how they describe it, is that they conceptualize the space as woman-only, so women can work and socialize without having to deal with men. So I think the wing is just part of that. That said, almost $2,000 a year to eat lunch, hold my bag, and get my hair blow dried. I'm thinking no.
It's a corporate thing. It's a corporate thing.
Well, no. You know, men have private clubs all over the place.
Indeed.
So, well, that's exactly so the should, point.
Yeah. So why shouldn't women have their clubs? I mean, where they can sit back in their easy chairs and recliners, smoke cigars, and eat chicken wings.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's exactly what they want to do.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I think if they advertised it as a socializing space and a space to work, that was more compelling. The wing thing just seemed a little
wing
bit
thing
embarrassing.
Seems
hot or mild.
Exactly. Well done, Charles. All right. My guests are Charles Richardson. He's the opinion page editor for the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. Roxanne Donovan is she teaches psychology and does a bunch of other things at Kennesaw State University. Forgive me for just bailing on your official title halfway through that. I work at a university, too, and my title is like half a page. So, all right. Julianne Thompson is a former press secretary for the Georgia Republican Party. She's with us, as is Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University. And we want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning. They are online at savannahcoffee.com. Let's talk about something a little bit weightier than chicken wings, which is where I can't believe we left things before the break. But public complaints about police officers dropped by 93% when those officers were wearing body cameras. That is according to researchers at the University of Cambridge in Britain. They studied two police departments in Southern California and four in the UK. This would seem to be an indication, seem to be some proof that body cameras have a beneficial effect. Charles, does this research surprise you?
Not at all. I would like to see them probably expand their research to places like Chicago, New York, some larger urban areas than the cities that they chose. But I totally understand why they used the cities that they studied. And also in the UK, you know, officers and citizens have a little bit different deployment with each other. But it doesn't surprise me one bit. The cameras seem to sort of make better citizens of everybody.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, what this research indicates is that public complaints about police officers dropping significantly when those officers are wearing body cameras, from which we can probably reasonably conclude that officers were doing fewer things that would provoke public complaints when they were wearing the cameras. Roxanne Donovan, same question to you. Does this research surprise you?
It surprises me in the amount that it dropped.
93%.
93% is crazy. And in fact, in some areas, it was 0% complaints. And I thought that was amazing. I think it provides considerable support for the use of body cameras. And the interesting part of the research, at least Dr. Barack Ariel's research, is that they found that even when not all police officers were equipped with a body cam, other police officers started acting in ways that were better in their interactions with the public. He called it a contagious accountability. And I think, wow, that's pretty impressive. You're not even wearing it, but watching the other people in blue act in a particular way is helping. So there's a spread effect beyond the cameras. So I'm all for that. I'm all for technological accountability.
Julianne, what do you make of the research?
I think it's wonderful. I agree with what everyone else said. I think that it's a win-win situation. I mean, first of all, as the other panelists said, you have police officers conducting themselves in a manner that they know is going to be viewed by the public if necessary. But also it protects the police officer as well from false accusations. So I think it's a win-win for both sides.
Hey, one thing, you know what I would love to see? I would love to see the way the data compares, because the Brits have a lot of cameras, and the average British citizen or subject is really used to having cameras all around him or her, whereas in the States we have a fraction of the cameras they have, so that would be interesting.
Interesting use of the term subject there.
Yeah, well,
notice that, Hector. You are literally correct. Yeah,
and Hector, you're right. Cameras do make us nervous.
Right. Let's go ahead and we'll vacillate here between serious things and not serious things. Let's see. Sesame Street is celebrating the 45th anniversary of the book, The Monster at the End of This Book.
Oh, hello, everybody. Oh, what is this? The Monster at the End of This Book. Starring lovable, furry, old Rover. Oh, that is me.
Okay, and of course, as people might recall, the premise of the book is that Grover there is terrified that there's apparently going to be a monster at the end of this book. He's very scared of monsters, and then when it gets to the end, oh, the only monster at the end of the book is Grover himself, and there's nothing scary about lovable, furry old Grover. This was one of my colleague Celeste Haley's favorite books as a kid. I've got a 2-year-old. I read this book to him once a week, I'd say. But what's kind of struck me as I've been reading him other children's books is how a lot of books that I remember from my youth as being really wonderful are actually really terrible books. guys, like Goodnight Moon is a terrible book. I mean, honestly, the poetry is awful. The illustrations are, the perspective is bizarre. And I can't get behind it. But anyway, so folks, these books, do you like them? Do you have a favorite children's book? Anybody still have kids young enough that you're reading to them?
The Cat in the Hat, which Ted Cruz massacred.
Oh,
there you go.
It's so hard to read, and it goes on and on and on and on.
It's beautiful. It's great.
No, it's a great book, but it's a heavy lift.
I used to read a book, and it's so old. I think it's out of publication, but it was called Snip, Snap, and Snur.
Mm.
And I tried to find it, and it's just. But you know, I'm 65 years old, so it was a long, long time ago. And my oldest son is 42, so I haven't read read a book in a long time.
Julianne, what was your favorite kid's book?
Oh goodness, I don't know. Probably different Dr. Seuss books. I enjoyed them, although my parents hated reading them. But you know, I just want to say a big congratulations to Sesame Street. They've done an outstanding job there. Actually, it's nice that something is actually older than I am. And I grew up on Sesame Street, and you know, and it's been great to be able to share that with my children as well. My youngest is 11, so I've been able to share some of my childhood memories, relive them with my children. So that's been wonderful.
And I have to say, there is video online of Ted Cruz absolutely killing a reading of Green Eggs and Ham. like nailing it. Roxanne, favorite kids book before we move on?
You know, I didn't grow up in the States, so I didn't have access to Sesame Street. So some of that is not very familiar to me, but I love reading to my kids, my boy and girl, 10 and 8-year-old, stories with very strong girl characters. And they're so hard to find. But my absolute favorite and my kids' favorite is The Paper Bag Princess. And she dumps the guy at the end. Oh, love it. Love everything about it.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Hector's here just shaking his head.
Not good.
We're talking about the week's news and other things here on The Break Room on GPB's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley today. With me is Roxanne Donovan, Hector Fernandez, Julianne Thompson, and Charles Richardson. It's been 15 years since singer Mary J. Blige released an album titled No More Drama. You probably remember it.
No more. No more.
Well, one can aspire, but it turns out that Mary J. Blige is still a drama magnet. She and her estranged husband, Kendu Isaacs, both filed for divorce in July amid rumors that he cheated. Isaacs has reportedly demanded nearly $130,000 per month in spousal support, saying that he needs the money for a personal chef, a personal trainer, and $5,000 per month to care for the kids that he has from a previous relationship. Now, granted, his demands would probably strike most people as exorbitant, but I'm wondering if our attitudes on spousal support have changed since the days when it really was created to help women who are abandoned by their husbands. Let's start with you, Roxanne.
I think in the world of the rich and famous, it has definitely changed, but child support is really necessary. I mean, 84% of custodial parents are mothers, 43% received some type of public assistance. So this is about making ends meet at the end of the day. And about 54% of those custodial parents do child support, do not receive it. Or don't receive what they're owed. This is a huge problem, and it's increasing the likelihood for women with children to be in poverty.
Yeah. That said, Hector or Charles, if either of you wants to take this on, men's rights activists, one of the number one things that they like to talk about is alimony reform laws. It can often be the case that even when a man is the lower wage earner, he may still be required in a divorce proceeding to make spousal support payments to his former wife simply because of their respective genders. Do you think that's a legitimate
issue?
That
makes no sense at all. I mean, this should be 50-50. If one of the two parties has a higher income, truly they have to pitch in. And it's basically what stands at the top is the child. That, you know, if the children must, their interest must be the utmost element in whatever solution you have in the divorce. So regardless of the party, any party that has a higher income, they have to pitch in. That's all.
I totally agree with what Westman said. But going to the Mary J. Blige situation, quite frankly, I'd be embarrassed to ask a judge, stand before a judge and say, I want child support for my other baby's children.
But it's amazing how much embarrassment can be assuaged by $150,000 a month.
Yeah, but my personal chef might get insulted. You know, I'm not paying him enough. You know, my personal chef is who I look at in the mirror every day. let's just say it hits me wrong.
Okay.
In that particular case. But everything that's been said, it should be 50-50. Yes, Mary J. Blige has a very good income, but this rusty bucket needs to get out and get a job.
Yep, pretty much.
Well, we've lost Julianne Thompson, the connection with her. We hope to get her back momentarily. Let's move on to another topic. It's been 30 years since the drinking age was raised to 21. Now experts are releasing some studies that show that there are some negative consequences if parents offer their child even a small taste of alcohol before they reach legal age. Some pieces of research indicating that kids are more likely to drink and even drink heavily later in life if their parents offer them even modest amounts of alcohol when they're young. Some parents feel that it is best that their kids be exposed to alcohol through them. Some parents feel that it's best if their kids and their friends try booze and drink at home where their parents can supervise and make sure that nobody blacks out and dies. Let's listen to an apropos clip.
Is there alcohol in this?
Oh, God, honey, no. What kind of mother do you think I am? Why, do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
No, thank you.
Okay. So, guys, what do you think? This is just a perpetual issue. And I while there is some research, it's hardly conclusive. Do you let your kids drink in the house? Do you give them a sip of wine at the table when they're little? What are our thoughts? Julianne, do you want to start?
I certainly don't think you do it when they're little.
Well, 12, 13. I think that's when my dad started giving it to me.
But, you know, I have mixed emotions about this. I mean, if you look at Europe, when I was in Italy, there were a lot of kids, you know, 15, 16 years old with their parents drinking a little bit of wine with their dinner, and it didn't seem to cause them to grow up to be alcoholics. However, that getting back to the point about raising the drinking age, here in the United States, that's one I really have mixed emotions about, because at 18 years old, we tell our young men and women that they're old enough to fight and die for this country, but they're not old enough to have a beer. So I really have mixed emotions about it. I think it has to be up to the individual parents.
Do we think that 18 is do we think that from that disparity that Julianne just mentioned, maybe it's that you shouldn't be able to go and fight and die for your country until you're 21? Anybody want to make that argument?
Oh, God.
Limbic system is not fully developed until the age of 25, guys.
Yeah.
You know?
No, well, basically, I don't know if there's ample research on many things, but in terms of, research available out there for the effects, the impact of alcohol before your brain is fully matured.
Yeah.
There is ample research to that. So to that extent, these are parents trying to be cool. These are parents trying to, you know, be friends with the kids. Guess what? That doesn't work very well. These are enablers. And I'm sorry, I do not agree with enabling.
And I think the United States has a huge binge drinking culture that's very unique to our space versus the European space. So I'm about consistency between deed and word. And if I'm saying that drinking to excess is difficult and not difficult, it's problematic, don't do it, then I need to behave in ways that are consistent. And not only in not giving my children alcohol, but I also need to not imbibe in front of them and show them that this is something that we don't do as a family. And hopefully when I engender those family values, when they go out in the world, they will behave in ways consistent with that.
You know, I've spent a good part of my life on college campuses, and I have seen what overindulgence of alcohol will do. All you have to do is walk through any tailgate. Oh yeah,
you smelled it too. I think.
I mean, all you have to do is walk through one tailgating party, and you can see exactly what can happen. Yeah. And when you have to write headlines of kids that have decided they were able to drink and drive, and they can handle it, and they don't show up in the next day, it can show you what and where did all that start. Where did those kegging parties start? Some of them started in the backyard of their parents' house.
Absolutely.
Let's go ahead and just talk very briefly about the news that we started with this show. Greg Bluestein from the AJC was on at the beginning of the show talking about a new AJC poll finding Clinton and Trump in a statistical tie right now in Georgia. Georgia, of all places. So really quickly, folks, what do we think that means? What does that signify that regardless of the eventual outcome, 3 weeks out from the election, Georgia, of all places, is in a statistical tie in the presidential race?
I think that, first of all, you and Greg also talked about the fact that you had Michelle Nunn showing as a statistical tie as well. And we saw the way that turned out. And then you can also look at the RCP average for the race between Jason Carter and Nathan Deal as being 44% to 48% just a few weeks out with a margin of error, an average margin of error of about 4%. And we saw the way that turned out. So I don't really think that you can go by polling. They're kind of snapshots in time, as we all know.
Precisely, but just to say that, I mean, what polling tells us is where things are now. It doesn't tell us where it's going to be in 3 weeks, but what does it mean that this is where we are at now, Roxanne?
I think it speaks to the uniqueness of what's happening on the presidential stage right now. What does it mean that Trump isn't getting the majority, the overwhelming majority of the votes, at least beyond the error, in Georgia? And I don't know. I don't know if it means anything. It may mean that we're purple this cycle, but will it impact anything down ballot? I'm thinking not. But I'd be interested to see.
Yeah.
Well, without alluding to any
of the... Hector, I'm afraid we got to leave it there. As Trump said, we're going to keep everybody in suspense. Listeners, we'd love to know what you think it means that this is where we're at in the race, 3 weeks to go. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Have yourself a great, great weekend.